The resources for the episode you are about to listen to will be listed at the end. We will also be playing a promo for you from our friend, Courtney, over at
Forensic Tales.
Over at Forensic Tales Podcast. Well, hello there, and welcome back to another episode of The Murder Diaries. That's Natalie.
And that's Paige. Thanks for joining us this week.
Yes, thank you so much, listeners, for being with us for another episode. This, of course, is one of our regular episodes where we will be telling you a true crime story. A little piece of housekeeping. Our open book episodes are now on Patreon. These are the chattier episodes where Natalie and I discuss anything and everything that's a bit newsworthy, usually related somewhat to true crime or some kind of mysterious type things that we're just discovering for the first time or that are current events. We do have a couple of those episodes on the regular RSS feed. So if you enjoy the chatty pieces, go check those out and then go ahead and join us on Patreon where you can enjoy some open book listening and support the podcast at the same time. Other than that, Natalie, I am, of course, excited to hear what story you're bringing us this week.
Well, this week we will be discussing the murder of Catherine Doreen Bright. And I just want our listeners to know that we're moving our resources to the end of the episodes from now on. So for those who are interested in what I used to research, you'll find them at the end. For this case, we're going to travel back in time to Wichita, Kansas in 1974.
I don't know if I want to go there.
Well, you don't really have a choice.
We're going.
Because that's where we're going. And as the largest city in Kansas, Wichita is an industrial hub of sorts. There are several universities, museums, theaters, etc. And part of the reason I bring this up is because as a California native, the mention of Kansas really just brings the thought of cornfields and farmers to mind. And I blame Wizard of Oz and the whole oft-repeated, I'm not in Kansas anymore saying, because that's how I imagined Kansas. So I had no idea it was this bustling city.
I just want to say that I agree. And I was completely joking, of course, as well. If I had an opportunity post-quarantine for a trip to Kansas, I'm sure I would go and absolutely enjoy myself. Here's a little bit of a funny tidbit, though. You can see Kansas from the deck of my in-law's house in Colorado.
What? I need to look at a map.
I had no idea except when my husband told me. And when you look out, when you know you're seeing Kansas, it's quite a little ways out, but there's like this little bit of a speck of a windmill. And my husband and my father-in-law were both like, that's Kansas. And it's a freaking windmill. Like, are you kidding? Like one of those tornado windmill things? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think of the movie Twister and how that one lady had a bunch of like windmills in her front yard and they were like going crazy when one of the tornadoes was coming. Oh, gosh. I'm so sorry. If you're from Kansas, we mean nothing by this. It's just silly, whatever. Anyways, so we're going. We're here. We're in Kansas.
Right. And I think it's really integral to our listeners to understand that this isn't, you know, some small town in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
It's, like I said, it's a bustling city. It's chock full of locals like Catherine Doreen Bright, who was 21 in 1974. She worked at Coleman while taking a full load of college courses and singing in her church's choir with her sister and a friend. And I just want to preface this by saying I searched and searched for more details of her personal life, but there wasn't much besides a brief mention of her love for singing and a handful of references to her smarts, her popularity, and her sense of humor. But I feel like that's all just very surface level.
Right.
And I'm sad because I think that this woman deserves to have her story told as completely as possible. So I did my best to find what I could, but I just want our listeners to know that unfortunately there isn't much out there about her.
This happens a lot.
Our listeners will soon understand why as we get into the story, but it's a bummer.
This is a new discovery of Natalie and I's, a certain type of case that involves not finding a bunch of backstory. And we'll definitely kind of get into that. And this episode is part of a series that we're doing, and we'll kind of be releasing at the end how this fits into that little bit of a series. It is way too often, just in general, that you really don't get a picture of who they were. And I don't think before we were doing the podcast, Natalie, that I ever really saw that. And if anybody was ever telling a story, whether it was a documentary or a podcast I was listening to, like, how did they not get that information? Why didn't they tell us this about that person? What is it? You know, you have all these questions and it's like, oh yeah, as podcasters, we still have them because the information just isn't out there. And it makes me wonder if it's available to people or why it was left out in those journalistic instances where we are still gathering the information. So to be continued on that part of the conversation as we unfold this case. And she was so cute, by the way. I mean, she's got this little bob. I mean, she's so cute.
Like, kind of an A-line bob. You know, yes. It's a little longer in front.
She's got the Karen bob. But you know what? She's rocking it, and it's adorable.
It's a youthful Karen bob.
Yes, because she was young. She was so young.
And she's actually smiling in the photo that I have of her. You know, a really happy smile. And she looks pleasant. Unfortunately, that's all we can really say.
Right.
Like we said,
she's just kind of that hometown kind of girl, you know. She didn't have this colorful past that's ever been painted for us in anything that we could find on her, at least.
Right. Pretty much, she was one of five kids. She, like, as far as I know, she had a sister that she sang in the choir with, and she has a brother. And we know she has a brother because on April 4th, 1974, Catherine Bright returned home to her residence at 3217 East 13th Street at 2 p.m. She was accompanied by her younger brother, 19-year-old Kevin Bright. As they enter the home, they pass a back bedroom, and that's when they heard a man say, "Hold it right there." And they looked over and saw the man standing there with a gun. He had been hiding in the house in anticipation of Catherine's return. Unbeknownst to him, she would be arriving with her brother, you know, so this was not expected.
Thought she would be alone.
Right. He expected
her to. And he's sitting waiting. What a coward. Like, that just irritates me so much.
What a creep.
Yeah. It's an extra layer of creep. I mean, of course, so it was like breaking in while someone's sleeping through their window or something like that. But there's something like strong, rude, and crude about that. Whereas if you kind of break in stealthily and you kind of just sit and wait, it just like, it shows you like you're a wimp. You're about to accost this human, but you have to sit there and wait. And like, there's something sick about the anticipation too.
He's almost savoring it though. Like,
yeah,
he's right. Marinating in this mindset and this preparation.
Yeah.
Ugh, it gives me the chills.
There's something so sick about that too. It's like a dichotomy for me of like this piece where it's cowardly because they're taking the best shot of like not getting caught and they're like afraid to do it while somebody might wake up. But there's also that sick piece where, yeah, they're savoring it, but they're also almost ensuring their success because they have full control of the situation by being able to find that hiding place or whatever before the individual that they intend to harm comes home. And in this case, it didn't necessarily do him that many favors because Kevin was with Catherine.
Right.
And so I wonder what was going on in this perpetrator's mind. Like, was it, oh shit, or was it like, great, now I gotta, you know, get this dude. Like, I wonder where they were at with it, you know? That's just my thinking, though.
I obviously have no idea what the offender thinks, but
we don't know how to think like them, so.
But I do believe that he was somewhat comfortable in handling more than one victim at a time, and we'll soon learn why.
Yep.
As we were saying, they come into contact with this man in Catherine's home. He has a gun. He tells them to basically freeze. And then he goes to say he doesn't want to hurt them. He just needs money and a car to drive to New York. And he is telling this story that is completely false. Mm-hmm. And he's saying he needs to go to New York because the police are after him for whatever reason. It's not important because it's not true.
He probably made some stupid thing up, or maybe he didn't even come up with a story and just like, the police are after me, I got to go to New York. You know, mm-hmm. It's like.
That's when the offender forced Kevin to tie up Catherine in the front bedroom. And the man afterward tied Kevin up in another bedroom. So he made sure to separate them.
Okay, and this isn't me blaming, but I'm wondering your take on this too. Like, when something like that happens, someone's in your home, you walk in, they tell you, hold it right there, and you hold it. This is not me saying anybody's wrong for doing that. I'm saying, why so often is it our human instinct to listen to somebody who is telling us what to do so they can't accost us?
Because he had a gun, lethal force, that he was clearly threatening to use against him. I could see where the fear and hesitation would come from.
You're thinking, okay, if I listen to them, they're not going to hurt me. But the chances are, yes, they are.
Right.
You know,
and I think it's awful. What the offender was trying to do by telling them, I'm not going to hurt you, and, you know, giving them this fabricated story was to ease their mind.
Stop them from wanting to escape and just
right and make it easier on himself. Right.
Yeah. And so she would feel comfortable mm-hmm. being tied up, and then him getting tied up, mm-hmm. her brother.
So the two Bright siblings are tied up. The offender rummages around the house and he returns to Kevin, the room Kevin's in, and he returns with a knotted stocking. He puts it around Kevin's neck and begins to strangle him. And it's at this point that Kevin jumps up onto his feet and he pulls the gun from the offender's waistband, points it at the offender, and pulls the trigger twice. And wouldn't you know, the gun didn't fire. How
freak.
Chilling. I mean, you know, he's thinking, oh my God, I am going to get out of this alive. And the gun jams.
That would have been it right there. Not only would they have the perpetrator, he'd be dead.
Right.
Or severely injured. Like, and where we're going with this story, it makes me wonder what would have become.
I mean, it would have been a completely different story.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess that makes sense in general, but wow. That's one of the saddest parts of this whole story was when that happened. And I'm not going to get too deep. Cut that. Because otherwise I'm skipping. So go for it. Keep going.
The offender then jerks the gun from Kevin and pulls the trigger and shoots Kevin.
Is it misfiring? What is going on with this gun?
That's what I don't get. Like, there's nothing in any of the research I have done that says why Kevin's specific shots didn't fire and why the offenders did. I don't know if maybe the safety was on. I don't know. It's frustrating, though, and it's sad, and it
makes me wonder.
It blows my mind.
Right. It is mind-blowing, especially with what we were just saying of, like, what would have become, but it makes me wonder if the offender purposefully sets the gun up to jam or misfire in case a situation like this does happen where somebody gets a hold of the gun and does try to shoot him. At least he knows he has some try, but I know guns do that too. And so do really old guns. So it makes me wonder about the gun.
I know it was a .22 caliber, but that's all I know.
Right.
I don't know the make, model, whatever.
My gun knowledge wouldn't know. And I know, again, that old guns, that can happen. Or, like, do you think about the guns that you play Russian roulette with? Where, you know what Russian roulette
is? Revolver?
Right. I believe that's what a revolver is or was, where it revolves. So if you don't have a bullet in every hole, then every shot's not going to have it. So it makes me wonder if there was a situation like that. Who knows? But that's... Look, listeners know by this time I like to talk everything out and then still have no answer. So that's just where we are with this. But it does make me wonder if it's that type of gun and or if something is done to the gun to cause something like that to happen momentarily so that the offender has a second to grab it back and not get injured. I mean, he could have been really well thought out.
Who knows?
Right.
In this case, it worked out in the offender's benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what happened. Kevin's on the floor. He's been shot. He's been strangled. And he's had a failed attempt at subduing the offender. Then Trudor left for a while, then returned to the room where Kevin was on the floor, cocked the gun, pointed it at Kevin, and shot him in the face. Satisfied that Kevin was dead, the offender left to the other room. And it's at this point Kevin's on the ground, plain dead.
Okay, so he's not dead, but the...
He's not dead.
But the offender thinks that he is. So he thinks he's safe, and now he's going to go do whatever it is he came to do in the first place.
Correct.
That's a lot of work just to harm a female. Like, this is grossing me out.
Correct. So the offender at this point believes he's subdued
the male of the house.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting? Her brother was only like 5'6 and 150 pounds. He was a smaller size guy, but he definitely put up a fight.
Yeah.
And that fight, you know, didn't even leave him when he was on the floor, shot twice, because as soon as the offender had left the room, Kevin got up and ran out of the house. Kevin ran across the street where he saw two men, and one of them took him to Wesley Medical Center, and the other called the police. Remarkably, Kevin survived.
Oh.
A neurologist performed emergency surgery, and during Holy that surgery, crap. Removed a bullet from his head.
Oh.
They installed a metal plate into his skull, and one of the wounds forced removal of several, I think up to 3 teeth. You know, present day, Kevin has had to live with lasting nerve damage from this encounter. But I don't want to get too far ahead of this day.
Sure.
When the police arrived at the home, Catherine was discovered bound with a cord, partially dressed, and had been stabbed several times in the abdomen. A few resources say below the ribs, and she also had been strangled. But she was clinging to life.
Whoa.
She was rushed to the hospital, and unfortunately, the brutality of the attack finally caught up with her. She succumbed to her injuries later that evening while at the hospital.
I wonder if it was today in 2020.
If she would have survived?
Right, because that medical technology over the last 40 years, 41 years, is pretty drastic. But I know it was still pretty modern in 79. But
74.
It is that much more advanced. Oh, yeah. Hello. Why do I keep thinking 79? I know that medical technology was still pretty modern. It wasn't like the Stone Age compared to today, but it just does make me wonder with the advances that we do have, makes me wonder. But I guess we really would never get that answer.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest,
just so sad. She was alive.
I know. And it's crazy to think that her brother was shot in the head and twice.
They got some good genes.
And he survived. So it really, I think, brings into focus the brutality of her attack, that she was, you know,
absolutely
so horribly, fatally injured that she wasn't able to survive. Later, after Kevin's released from the hospital, he finally learns of his sister's death. He actually never saw his sister's body, and really no one even told him what the final outcome had been until he had been released, because I have to imagine it was partially due to like not wanting to impede his own recovery. You know what I mean? Like,
that's exactly why they do it. I know this happens a lot with major vehicle accidents that do relate in casualty or casualties, that they will not tell the driver or others involved that have survived, who is still with us and is a fellow survivor, or who, you know, who has not survived. And even with kids versus parents, and it's very upsetting, but it's going to be more upsetting and more dangerous to their health and their overall recovery if they do know. So think about how hard it is knowing that you have a possibly passed away family member. It's that much worse when you find out that that is the unfortunate truth. So I've definitely heard of that in multiple different types of situations.
Once Kevin had recovered enough to be interviewed by the police, he told the investigators that the intruder was 5 feet, 10 inches, 180 pounds, and around 25 to 30 years old, with a mustache and dark hair. And despite surviving the attack, the physical description of the offender and the quick acting of the Good Samaritans across the street, investigators were at a loss. They didn't have any leads on who would commit such a heinous crime. Weeks turned into months and eventually years. And so time went. 1975, 1976, 1977, 1978. And this is when the offender sent a letter to a television station, Cake, in Wichita. And in the letter, he claimed responsibility for the murders of Catherine Bright and five others. Among them was a family of parents and children and two single women, unrelated single women. In the same letter, Catherine's murderer suggested many possible names for himself, including one that stuck. And that name was BTK.
Bind, torture, kill.
For those of you who may be hearing this story for the first time, this is the infamous BTK killer of Kansas, who essentially got himself caught. And I think that's probably almost as infamous as his, you know, rampage throughout the 70s and 80s of Wichita.
BTK, bind, torture, kill. It was very hot to trot on himself. Oh. Very proud of himself. Letters to newspapers, all kinds of stuff. And not unlike, I want to kind of joke around saying our fave, but I think that's a little bit of a gross joke that maybe only true crime fans would
I think it's okay.
Appreciate.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. I think he's just one of our, you know, one of the ones we love to knock and, you know, tell a story about or, you know, just learn about whatever. He, too, had a gap between his final two episodes.
Right. But you're kind of jumping ahead, so I'm going to fill in some stuff. No, that's okay.
Go for it. Fill us in. There's so much. I mean, there's so much to talk about when it comes to this point.
Kind of like you mentioned, he was an attention whore. Let's be honest. He demanded the media's attention, and it was finally announced by the Wichita police that they indeed had a serial killer on their hands.
It took them a while, didn't it?
It did, and I think it was around this time. BTK kind of forced the police's hand in this announcement.
Yes, he wanted it.
He wanted the attention, and he wanted the acknowledgement of his crimes or, you know, his little projects, as he liked to call them.
Ugh.
And in this letter, he actually claimed that he was driven to kill by a certain factor X. And I did air quotes.
Fill us in on why there's air quotes.
And he described this factor X as a supernatural element that motivated the likes of Jack the Ripper and Son of Sam and the Hillside Stranglers. So he's really using this attention grab to place him on this like pedestal of like infamous serial killers. You know what I mean? He sees himself as now a part of that serial killer lore.
Right. He didn't want to just be, hey, Kansas has a serial killer. Everybody be careful. Keep your kids inside. Don't go out alone at night. He wanted to be a name that people remembered.
Remembered and feared.
Remembered and feared. That's a great way to put it. And lest you guys forgot, there are so many serial killers in history, you literally could not know them all. And there are always about 40 to 50 active, so some research says. So with that, you'll never know all of their names. So the names that you do remember,
it's a big deal.
It is a big deal to be one of the ones that people remember. And I hate to say that he got what he wanted.
Yeah.
Most true crime fans and a lot of non-true crime fans know BTK, what that means, or at least are familiar with a serial killer that was named BTK.
After this second letter, he killed a few more victims and the cases went cold. The years went on and through the 90s, through the 2000s, and we finally land in 2004. The investigation into the BTK killer is considered a cold case.
Yeah, and people were still pretty terrified because this guy was still out there for like 30 years. Nobody knew what happened, where he went.
Well, and that's the thing. I have read different accounts of why he chose to do what I'm going to now describe. But a lot of them say that his name fell out of conversation. He wasn't a trending topic anymore because these cases had gone cold, because there was no more activity going on.
And you bring up a good point where if there's no activity, they used to tend to lead to, okay, they're possibly still at large, but you know what? They probably moved or they got arrested for another crime or they're dead.
Right.
And in this case, those three options that are so often pushed to ease public mind, none of them had happened.
Right.
None of them.
So Rader initiated a series of 11 communications to the local media. And ironically, this is what eventually led to his February 2005 arrest. And I didn't write it down just because I know everyone knows this part of the story, but, or at least has seen the meme of BTK telling the police, hey, can you get information off an old floppy disk? And the police tells him, no, we're not lying. Of course you can't get information off an old floppy disk. But that's exactly what happened. He had sent them information from a floppy disk. He had thought he removed all past information, traces of his work. But on that floppy disk, police investigators were able to recover a name of a church. And not only did it have the name of the church, but it had a name. And the name was Dennis. So with a quick Google search of that church and the name Dennis, Dennis Rader popped up. And what
Dennis Lynn Rader.
Yes. Dennis Lynn Rader, at your service. He was then arrested while driving near his house. And when he was pulled over, the arresting officer asked him, do you know why I'm putting you into custody? And Dennis Lynn Rader responded, I have an idea. That was like his, he was almost, and I'm sure people can read it a differently in their own heads, but when I read that, it was almost like I imagined him having this smirk on his face, like this very smug response from him, almost happy at finally being acknowledged for his crimes.
Yeah, I guess it's that thing of just him getting the attention he wanted that way. And he knew news coverage was going to be coming and that he was the infamous BTK. And now he was going to be able to show his face. That's kind of sick.
He was a master manipulator and he manipulated his way into the spotlight.
Yes.
And District Judge Greg Waller formally set Rader's bail to $10 million. And he was appointed a public defender to be his legal representative.
Whoa, public defender on a $10 million bail.
Right?
I'm not in the legal field, but I'm pretty sure that that's rare.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know, actually. Maybe I'm just connecting public defender versus a high amount of bail. I just feel like most of the time, if you did such a heinous act that is worth a $10 million bail, which would probably be like, I don't know, $15,000-$25,000 bail today, maybe even more. I just feel like you should get paid counsel. I don't know. Public defenders don't do this type of case a lot.
Perhaps his family, you know, didn't want to.
Well, they easily couldn't afford it or didn't want to. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I get it. And I'm glad our legal system has public defenders. I'm not calling them bad. I'm just saying the experience with that type of defense, that's just not there for a public defender. It's just not. Mm-hmm. It's like telling a kindergarten teacher to go teach seventh grade. They're going to need to get a different credential. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. That's sounding like I think public defenders are bad and I'm having a really hard time explaining it. So whatever.
So I don't want to get too much into Dennis Rader, aka BTK's life history, because I don't think he matters in this telling of the story. This story is about mm-hmm. Catherine. This story is about Kevin and his survival. Yes. And this is just, I want to give a little brief review of the public's reaction to finding out that Dennis Rader was the infamous killer BTK. And I think a lot of their reaction of bewilderment and just confusion and disbelief was rooted in the fact that he played a large role in his Christ Lutheran church for 30 years. And so during...
Was very liked in his church, too. I mean, he wasn't beloved. Like this creepy guy, like, oh, yeah, he was always a little off, but we welcomed him. No. He was a family man. He was well-liked in that church.
And so much so that the pastor even visited Dennis Lynn Rader while he was in custody. And they had a 45-minute conversation, like the first time he had seen him. And he went several times after that. And he refused to divulge, you know, what they had talked about because he felt like it was privileged information. But
I actually respect that in a way because I think that it shows not necessarily if the pastor was on his side or not, but just looking from the outside right now, I'm wondering if it shows that this pastor actually knew how to have unconditional positive regard for the congregation. I'm Catholic, so we call it a parish. His congregation, the people there, it actually kind of shows that he does have an unconditional positive regard. But what's your take?
I haven't formed a stance yet. And I don't, I feel like by saying anything would just be premature.
True.
Because I haven't really given it much thought, to be honest. I wanted to point that out just because it shows the level of depth of the relationship he had with the church elders and those like the pastor.
Yeah.
Dennis Lynn Rader eventually pled guilty on June 27th, 2005. He was convicted for murder in the first degree on 10 counts. While in custody, he was actually evaluated by a criminal psychologist. And this criminal...
Ooh, what did they have to say?
Well, let me tell you. That I feel like we would have assumed anyway, but I'm going to go ahead and read it out.
Oh, good. Thought you might.
He was diagnosed with narcissistic, antisocial, and obsessive compulsive personality disorders. He had this very grandiose sense of self and considered himself to be privileged and special and above others, which I think only a serial killer, I can't see a serial killer thinking any way else about himself. How else can you go out there and murder 10 plus people? It wouldn't work, I don't think.
The entitlement to another human, one you perhaps don't know, and many times serial killers, it can be somewhat random, maybe stalking for a certain amount of time, but again, somewhat random, someone you don't know. When we're talking about serial killers specifically, obviously the most common type of murder is within, you know, somebody you know, family, relationships, etc. But when we're talking about serial killers specifically, a lot of times it's random. And it's just so gross when you break it down and think about the entitlement they felt that they had to another human's life. And I think that that speaks to kind of exactly what you're saying, you know? Mm-hmm. Just that above everybody doesn't matter. It's kind of like the people who think that, cool, I can leave my water bottle here. I can throw my mask on the ground.
I mean, this is on a grander scale, of course.
Right. But it's that type of thinking where you have the entitlement to that. And mm-hmm. I think I actually argue entitlement to the earth and littering and things like that is, I'm not going to call you a sociopathic serial killer, but I am going to say I think that that's bad,
it's
because
selfish.
You're not caring about your, it is, and you're not caring about those around you, and you're not caring about the people that are going to be here 100 years from now. So
after all this, Kevin Bright, Catherine Bright's brother, who fought for his life,
yeah, is where's he?
The only known person to have survived an attack by PTK.
Okay. I never put it like that, but that makes sense.
Yeah, he's the only known survivor, and he actually filed a civil suit against Dennis Lynn Rader.
What did that look like?
He sought $75,000 for damages, including medical expenses, lost income, pain, suffering, disability, disfigurement. I don't know what he looks like, but he included that. And mental anguish. And it was the
fourth.
Please
tell me he got the money.
I have no idea. I couldn't find it.
But gosh, you know, this is public record. So please, all of our web sleuths out there, please get this information for us and DM us. I want anybody who lived in Kansas, had parents that lived in Kansas at this time, older brothers, sisters, aunts, whoever, that lived in Kansas at the time the BTK was active, please DM us. I want to know all about that. Because I remember I was like 16, 17 when all this was kind of happening, and kind of 18 by the time, or right around the time that he finally kind of had everything solidified in his trial and everything, from what I remember. Let's see, when was his sentencing?
2005.
Right, okay. So that's when I turned 18. So I have quite a memory of this, and it's one of the memories that made me feel like, holy cow, serial killers aren't a thing of like the 70s, you know? Yeah. And I remember my mom definitely remembered who BTK was. And I can't say she was like glued to the TV about it, but I do remember like it was at a national level of news. Like everybody knew who BTK was, and as was it when he got caught.
People still make references to him. Look at Mindhunter.
Oh my gosh.
You know,
Mindhunter. Ugh.
The character played a role in towards the end of season one, and then at the start of season two. And, you know, Dennis Lynn Rader, a.k.a. BTK, is still in jail. He's 75 years old and will be there for the rest of his natural life.
And rightfully so. You see his daughter out there quite a bit, you know, and she's had some quotes and interviews and things like that. Those are definitely interesting to catch.
I remember reading about when the daughter received the news of her father's arrest for being the BTK killer.
Yes, yes.
And she said she literally fainted because just she like could not process the information she was receiving. And I can't even imagine how horrible. I mean, they're also right. Victims.
Absolutely. And I feel like she's had a really strong stance. I can't say that she's said anything too nasty, in my opinion, but I can't say she's completely stood by his side. I think she did a good job of just
being neutral,
you know, living in her world. And I mean, I definitely know that she's not like, I'm still supporting my dad. But no, that's like not a thing. But I mean, yeah, as you mentioned, you couldn't imagine because exactly that was not her world. Can you imagine right now, those of you that have relationships with your father, whether it's good or bad, now just think that you learned that that man...
The man who walked you down the aisle, because I believe he did.
He might have. She's... Okay, I'm not going to like say her name on here just because. Serial killer's daughter, my story. She has a book. We can plug it. It's called A Serial Killer's Daughter, My Story of Faith, Love, and Overcoming.
I guess we'll have to check that out for our next book club.
Absolutely. Wow. How strong is that to like fully write a book? Now, this is where we may actually really get a taste of where she's at today, where she was then, the fainting. I get the fainting again because her entire world shifted with one sentence. Your dad is BTK. And
well, and I think that underscores the level of deception he was capable of, because he was living such a seamless double life that his inner family, his immediate family, had no idea what he was doing.
Well, you got to remember too, they obviously were living through this horrific experience of a serial killer on the loose named BTK.
Yeah. And to find out that he's the one who...
That it's him?
Oh,
yeah.
Horrible. Anyway, I don't want to go off too far talking about him.
We could go on and on. Yeah.
But that is the story of Catherine Doreen Bright.
Well, we could definitely go on and on and on, because that's what happens with serial killers, and that's why sometimes their victims get a little bit buried in the overall narrative. So we appreciate and honor the experience of being able to tell the specific stories. And this story is part two of our serial killer victims three-part series. Thank you for joining us this week. Until our next episode, you know where to find us at themurderdiariespod@gmail.com. At the Murder Diaries Pod on Instagram. We absolutely love talking to you guys. Our listeners are the best. Our Instagram followers are the best. So we really enjoy interacting with you. And don't be a stranger. Slide into those DMs.
If you have a chance and you enjoyed this episode, go ahead and rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen.
Please do.
You know, it helps us out.
Helps us continue bringing you fantastic content. You can also support us by becoming a patron on Patreon. Link is in our bio on Instagram or searchable on Patreon. We would so appreciate your support. If you do join us on Patreon, you will be able to access our chatty open book episodes.
Can I plug my bracelets, or is that terrible?
That's not terrible at all. You can also support... If Natalie's mental health by purchasing her amazing, very beautiful bracelets. I'm not kidding. They're gorgeous. They're real gold. They're real silver.
Visit the site at natzoe.com, NATZOE.com, or our Instagram, shop natzoe. I probably won't plug it again, but I thought, hey, why not?
Well, I probably will, because I have a natzoe bracelet in my mailbox right now waiting for me to go get it, but well, I'm too lazy. It's too hot out there to go to my mailbox right now, but whatever. Anyways, you guys, until then,
better safe than dead.
Bye.